Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hello, you're listening to the DC Public Library on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. This episode is part of All Things Local, where we highlight D.C. history, culture, and communities, and Washingtonians who have made an impact on our city. I am your host, Ray Barker, an archivist in the Special Collections Department at the MLK Library. Today, I am joined by Mike Tremonti. Mike has an interesting history, unique to D.C. and Georgetown in particular. Today, we'll be talking about the club, The Bayou, his connection to it, and a little bit later, we'll talk about a panel and promote some of the details about that that's tonight. So, Mike, welcome.
Thank you, Ray. Good to be here.
How's it going?
Going well. Woke up this morning. The bar is pretty low these days.
Yeah. So, you get out. Do you get out to D.C. much, or do you get in this area much?
Yeah, I still get into the clubs a little bit, what's left of them to some extent, but... Yeah, I try to stay current.
Okay. So I was going to say we have two reasons at least to be together today talking. So one of them is about the history of the music venue, The Bayou in Georgetown. And secondly is to promote the panel that we're both involved in tonight with a handful of other folks with a similar history. So can we dive right in and talk a little bit about The Bayou and your relationship to it? Let's start there.
Of course. My family started The Bayou in 1953. It was a Dixieland Jazz Club back then. It was my father, my uncle. They had another partner, Mr. Mike Munley. And from there, I guess we had the club until 1998, 99. No, excuse me. The club was in existence until 98, 99. We sold the club to Solid Order Productions in 1980. So we were Dixieland Jazz until the mid-60s, and that's when we went rock and roll.
Right, and I, just as a guy who's really into history, one of the things about The Bayou is that appeals to me is the history before it. And so a lot of my reference point for this history, and maybe it is for other people if they weren't around at the time, like I wasn't, for any of this, was, you know, the Pirates Cove and all that. Back, going back to the 30s and 40s, it has kind of a unique, crazy, colorful history. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, colorful is certainly, might be understating it a little bit, but as history goes, it was originally a copperage. And some people will say, had you been in the club, it actually slanted towards the K Street. It's a little bit of a dip. And people said that was so they could roll the barrels out. I think that might have been apocryphal. But again, you mentioned it was called the Bucket of Blood. It was the Pirate's Cove. I believe it was called the Town and Country at one point in time. And the way my dad acquired the club was because there was a shooting there. The closest thing, so I've been told, that D.C. had as far as a mobster was concerned in those days was a fellow named Joe Nesline. And apparently he... made all the book in town and illegal gambling and things of that nature. And somebody owed him some money. They were sitting up on the balcony for anybody who's familiar with the club. And they were coming down the staircase, and he shot this guy dead. He wasn't getting his money, and he wasn't happy about it.
And if I had sound effects, I'd make the sound of the gunshot right now.
Of course.
But we can all imagine what that would sound like.
The ABC board, or whoever the powers would be at that time, immediately closed the club down. The interesting thing is that Mr. Nesline was acquitted. He admitted he had to shoot the guy, but for some reason or another, that jury didn't see it that way. And I'll let your own imagination run with that one.
Sure, we can just imagine that, how those deals were made.
Right.
So 3135 K Street Northwest, it was under the bridge, and right... Today, it's the movie theater, or do I have that wrong?
Under the famous Whitehurst Freeway. And it was right in between, yes, the movie theater and the Ritz-Carlton. And I believe there's a little ice cream store there now. And that looks to me to be the spot. It's a little difficult to visualize now. It's changed so dramatically. But that was the place.
Okay. And so your father, Vince, and your uncle,
Tony.
Tony, thank you. And then the third partner?
Mike, who was only there for a short period of time. They parted ways after about the first year or 18 months. So from there on, it was my dad and my uncle.
Right. And so one wants to imagine you and your brother, Vince, your older brother, Vince, and your younger brother, Bobby.
Right.
I know that I've got the time frame a little bit weird, but maybe you and your brother Vince are running around the bar as kids. I mean, do you have memories of that?
I do. Again, I was born in 52, so I was a little young for the early days. But in some of the jazz days just before it went rock and roll, we'd be down there as kids. You know, we'd get a big thrill out of going to the, you know, they'd have the soda machine where you'd have the ginger ale and the Coca-Cola and the club soda. And, you know, we'd grab a glass, the bartender give us a glass and put a cherry in it. We'd go mix our drinks there. You know, we'd have a little Coke and a little ginger ale, a little of this. Thought that was pretty exciting.
But when did you, I mean, later as an adult, then your role in the club became more significant?
Even started a little earlier than that, in the sense that I was a musician of sorts, so I had the opportunity to actually play in the club in the early rock and roll days, just short periods of time, two or three nights, when the Telstars were out on another gig, and my dad pulled some strings and got my little high school band in there to play. Played later on for a full summer, actually in the early 70s. So I was involved on a musical level, and then later on worked my way up from a busboy and ultimately ended up managing the club until the sale of it in 1980.
And then Bobby was involved too. And did Vince work for the club, or is it just you and Bobby?
My brother Vince would go down in a different capacity. I don't know that Vinny ever officially worked there because he was a little bit older. He was going to law school at the University of Virginia. But he would fill in as a bartender from time to time. Go down, open the place up, things of that nature. So he was certainly familiar with the club.
And so the documentary, I watched a little bit of it this morning just in preparation for our panel this evening. I may as well make the plug now and I'll mention it later. But so tonight at the Georgetown Public Library, Mike is serving on a panel. It's called Last Call, The Bayou Cellar Door in Georgetown Nightlife. We're doing a partial screening of the documentary from 2013, made locally by a film production company here. We'll talk more about that in a bit. So The Bayou, DC's Killer Joint, is the documentary. We'll show 15 minutes of that, the first 15 minutes. And then Mike will talk about the good old days with The Bayou and Bill Scanlon from the production team. I think he was a producer on that documentary. Richard Harrington, you may know, retired music, pop music critic from the Washington Post. And Surf Colwell, his big-time DJ back in the day and still very active on musicplanetradio.com. And maybe my favorite, I don't want to pick favorites, but the unique personality and charm of Mike O'Hara.
Well, and Surf, of course, was at the legendary station WHFS, which I'm sure many of your listeners will remember to this day. And Scanlon, if I'm not mistaken, I believe he was running DC 101.
Oh, so
back in the day, probably when Howard Stern was there. If I could have some of my dates wrong, but along with what they do now, they were very integral in that music scene back then.
Right, and so I was mentioning that documentary. I watched it this morning. I'm cutting it at the 15-minute mark for tonight's purposes, and right at 15 minutes, we're in 1965. One of the themes of these venues is the evolution of things, how things change and transition. And just in the time that we've spent together, you know, it was Dixieland and became, you know, that there was a, you know, like a cabaret, not a cabaret, but a the dancer, the female dancer.
Julie Gibson, an exotic dancer.
Exotic dancer, thank you. You know, these different forms of entertainment. O'Hara's history is certainly an indication of that. But so 1965, that rock and roll is sort of, you know, become popular. And then the Telstars are seen out, you know, in Ocean City
at the Beachcomber. And just backing up to that a little bit, I mean, Dixieland had a terrific run. My father even used to say, he says, you know, you rarely see overnight successes, but the club was a hit. It was a hit very quickly. But Dixieland was dying. I mean, it just wasn't happening. In fact, that's why they brought in Julie Gibson from Philadelphia as an exotic dancer because the club, in some respects, was on its last legs. They still kept the Dixieland band there, but they didn't know where they were going with it. It didn't look like it was going well. And that's when, God bless rock and roll, that's when rock and roll kicked in. My dad went down to Ocean City, a gentleman named Joe Rinaldi, who was part of the Dixieland band but had a heck of a good ear. And he said, "Vince, there's this band down there called the Telstars." He said, "They're packing them in." And they were. And the Telstars came up to the Bayou, and people won't believe this these days, but they had a three-year run there. That was a house band for 3 years. And it was the heyday of rock and roll in Georgetown. I mean, everybody had a line, but everybody was jumping. It was quite a time.
Right, and they weren't doing originals, if I understand correctly. They were doing popular hits of the time. Is that correct?
It was. The club in general, for at least the duration of our family's ownership, it was typically, you know, what you'd call top 40 today. You were playing the hits. There was some original material being done. Sometimes I felt that maybe, you know, we didn't encourage that. It wasn't necessarily what worked for business. It wasn't that a band wasn't allowed to do original material, but it had to fit into the format.
Mm-hmm.
It worked from a business standpoint. Sometimes, as being a musician myself, I felt like we discouraged some of the great original material and talent that was in this town.
And so I was going to point out, so this is another interesting fact, at least to me. So in the Dixieland days, in the jazz Dixieland, I guess I don't want to get, you know, caught up in genre terms and such like that, but...
Well, and not to step on it a little bit, but it's funny because I remember asking my dad, I said, "Why Dixieland jazz versus jazz?" And he said, "Simple, Mike." He says, "Look around. Look at Charlie Bird's place. Look at this gentleman's place." He said, "You know, God bless jazz people." He says, "They are real aficionados. They sit. They listen. They pay attention. They don't spend money. They don't drink." He said, "The Dixieland crowd is a party crowd." It had 500 seats in the club. You needed a lot of people partying there to pay the bills.
And that's an interesting point. And I was going to finish that, but I can follow up with that in a second. But there were major Dixieland artists playing at the Bayou.
There were. They had a great local band, which, again, you know, what's new is old again. I mean, we always had local bands that carried the weight for the rock and roll, but it was the same with the Dixieland groups.
Dixieland Six? Is that
it was the Foggy Bottom Six, but Woody Herman and the Herd played there. Count Basie played there. Illinois Jacquette, a great clarinet player there. Wild Bill Davidson. So they had their share of big-time players coming as well, but the local talent was always their bread and butter, no question, through both eras.
And I was going to say that the influence or the influx of rock music and how to make a dollar at a club, you know, it's all about kind of the bottom line, but dancing, right? Is that what was part of this too, is that rock and roll permitted people to dance, whereas, you know, same with Dixieland, but jazz music, like you said, people are going to sit and just listen.
Oh, I think that's exactly right. The place, it got a little louder, it got a little crazier, maybe it got a little younger, but the business model didn't change that much in terms of what worked. Not sure men and women change as much as we think they do from time to time. I mean, it was back then in the union days, it was 40 minutes on for a band, 20 minutes off. And I believe in the contract, if I'm not mistaken, my dad had it in there that the band had to play two slow songs.
Hmm.
Just two slow songs, the dad says, "You know what?" He says, "Guys and girls still like to dance together. They like to get close once in a while." He was right.
So you bring up your dad, and I found this fascinating. We talked many, many months ago for part of an oral history I'm doing on the area. But one of the things about your dad that you mentioned, you know, I think he was a lawyer by day, if I have that correctly. But the thing, do you know where I'm going with this? His singing career. And it just sounds like he could have been, you know, world-class singer in along the lines of a Frank Sinatra. Is that right?
He was the exact same age. He was born in 1915. You've seen the pictures. I mean, he certainly had the look and the style. He had won several competitions in terms of singing, both in New York and up and down the East Coast. But this guy from New York ends up going to Mr. Jefferson's University. He received a scholarship to go down there for what was called tumbling back then. Up in New York, this was predominant, not in the South. It evolved into gymnastics, and that's how he ends up in Charlottesville. But he had his own band down there. He put himself through school to some extent with the money made from that. But at the same time as one of these larger talent shows were coming up in New York on the radio, could have been Arthur Godfrey. I'm not certain of that. But at the same time, his law boards were coming up, and his mom, she was a very gregarious, very sharp businesswoman, Italian, obviously. She goes, look, we didn't go through all this schoolwork for you to end up being some saloon singer. And that was the end of that. He continued to love it. I'm sure the Bayou was an extension of that.
Right. And did you hear him singing around the house?
We didn't have any choice. And he was asked to sing. We'd see him. There were variety shows for the Knights of Columbus he was very involved in. People would ask him to sing at weddings and things of that nature. But he loved it. It was very important to him.
Nice. And so we said the Telstars played for three years. The house band, how rare that is to just have that regular gig, that the same group. And then the people that went to the club, of course, kind of supporting that local sound or whatever you want to call that. And so one of the other themes of the panel tonight is that what is local? What does local sound like to DC? That's one of these pseudo-philosophical questions in a way. But I didn't know if you had other local bands or local flavor that you guys supported along the likes of Telstars.
Well, we did. I find it so interesting now. Of course, we've got Surf coming on later on tonight, this evening. I'll be curious to hear his take on this. But there was something called Top 40. So, yes, we had bands playing the music of the times. But we'd have a band like the Nighthawks, which, again, DC's great blues band, one of the great blues bands in the country, quite frankly. Billy Joel used to refer to them as his favorite band. We could have, again, a straight top 40 band in there one evening. We'd have the Hawks come in for a couple of weeks at a time. We'd have Face Dancer come in. They had three different deals on Capitol Records. A little bit more of a Genesis progressive type of group. And it all worked. I think it was an interesting commentary on the times. It got to the point where they'd come to see a band. Each band certainly had a following. That goes without saying. But there were a certain number of people just came to the Bayou because it was the Bayou, and whoever was there, they knew the group was going to be good.
Yeah, so there's that. Yeah. They met the standard or that particular curatorial taste of the Bayou, which is, how would you define that or describe what that is for your venue?
Well, my dad always told me, he says, make sure you describe it as, if the band's at the Bayou, they're the best band in town. I think he caught me once being a little too critical of a group that was there, not saying that.
Next time, just don't say it where he can hear
you.
Yeah,
exactly. But I'm not so sure people's minds weren't a little bit more open. Again, to me, it seems like the music now, is at least the listening, is so compartmentalized to some extent on what people listen to. Maybe because there's so many different ways to receive your music now they don't get to hear. I mean, Top 40, you could hear Yes one minute, you could hear the Eagles the next, you could hear the Beatles the next. I don't think that happens much anymore.
Right. And I know that there's I'm a sucker for stars and rock and roll bands and performers, individuals or bands, coming through. And Little Feat was one. I mean, some of the major acts that kind of came through there.
Actually, Little Feat never worked for us. Little Feat had an extraordinary following in D.C. early on, probably primarily because of a gentleman named Mike Schreibman who really could, sometimes I think he knew an act was going to be great before they even knew it. And they got big. They could sell out four shows at the Werner Theater, Listener Auditorium. But we did catch some good ones on the way up. I mean, Kiss played at the Bayou.
76? 75?
75, I think. We'll get Richard Harrington on that, but I do remember Richard's review was something to the effect of it was the loudest band he had ever heard his entire career as a rock critic. And they had the whole Kabuki thing going. I mean, they were slated to go big. They broke the Capitol Center's attendance record 9 months later, which was never to be broken because the fire marshal cut it back after that.
And is your sense, KISS is such an interesting group, of course. They were just playing a gig. Is that right? They were just stopping through on their way to... I guess I'm saying this precedes their popularity by quite a bit. Is that right?
Well, again, 9 months later, they were selling out the Cap Center.
Yeah.
That's so pretty quick.
Quick turnaround, yeah.
I think the fix was sort of in. Somebody put a lot of dough into that. I'm sure that's in writing somewhere now. Mm-hmm. But again, they had the makeup artist, the whole thing there. There was... Whatever they were making at the Bayou wasn't, paying for that.
Right.
The tickets were $3 a piece.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at. It sounds like it was a tier, a certain tier at that time, which very quickly, as you said, became another, a much higher, larger tier.
But again, KISS being somewhat unique, we had Foreigner there, we had Dire Straits, we had UFO, Richie Furay, Robert Gordon.
And Todd Rundgren was one, right?
Todd Rundgren, The Police.
Yeah.
Todd Rundgren, of course, one of my personal favorites, which was exciting. Hall and Oates.
And you got to meet Todd Rundgren, is that right?
I did. It was one of those rare occasions where I'd been a fan all the way back to the NAS, and I was a little leery of that. Sometimes you don't want to meet your heroes; they turn out to be not so nice. But Rundgren was as professional as anybody who worked there. If the show starts at 8, he's on into his first song by 8:01. Later on, we did two shows a night for two nights, completely sold out, and they were kind enough to invite us back. They were staying at the Watergate. It's in 1978, and I would call Rundgren. If anybody knows anything about him, he's a very technical guy. He's created a lot of software. He was telling us about these little movies that were going to come out. It was going to be the end of records and vinyl and all the rest of it, and they'd be like little vignettes that you'd see on the TV, and we're going, what is the world is he speaking of? And of course, 2 years later, MTV came around, and that's exactly what he was talking about.
Right. And then you were working there at that time then, right? That
was, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And then when did you end your tenure there? Did you stay through the end, or...
I did. I guess I got started in about 1974, and I was there right through the sale to Celador Productions, and they kept me around for a few months to show them where the light switches were and that type of thing.
Right. Can we talk about some of the other venues around at that time? So tonight's panel, as you heard, is we're talking about the Celador, but there are other... I love hearing the names of these old clubs in Georgetown, the idea that you could have... So to go back a little bit, main motivation for even diving into any of this stuff was that it was such a vital music part of the city, and you could walk around and go to club to club and hear different styles of music depending upon where you went. And this is partly based on what I've heard and partly my imagination, that was the neighborhood of Georgetown.
Yeah. You could start at the top of Wisconsin Avenue. It was a club called the Act Four. Group called The Reasons Why I played there. They were a terrific act. Come down the street a little bit further, there was The Keg, which was a little bit of a, I say this in a very complimentary way, a little bit of a dump, but had some, I stole a lot of good bands out of The Keg. Billy Patterson, who was the manager there, had a terrific ear for music. The Cherry People were one of those groups who we've spoken about. Come down to the bottom of Wisconsin Avenue, there was the Silver Dollar, the Crazy Horse, Winston's, the Pall Mall, the Round Table, later on Desperados, of course Celador was there as well. So on any given night you could go see, on a weeknight, see four or five terrific local bands, and for no money, no cover charge, just go in and buy a drink. Mm-hmm. And that was just Georgetown.
Right.
There were other things happening in town too. The Child Herald, the Mr. Henry's, where Roberta Flack came out of. Mike O'Hara had his joints, The Gentleman Too. My Mother's Place. So it was a vibrant town. There's no question about it.
Can we talk about the closing of the Bayou? I'm curious, we were talking earlier about its legacy. The Bayou today and its legacy. And do people know of it?
It's a... It's a great question. It was interesting because for the longest time you could mention the Bayou to folks all the way from, you know, 12 years old to 60 years old, and they knew it in some capacity. The 12-year-olds knew it as a place they wanted to go as soon as they were old enough to get a fake ID. They'd see the ads for it. The older generation knew it from Dixieland jazz days. I mean, you went for a long period of time where everybody knew of that club in some fashion. They'd been there. But now I must admit, well, the suburbs hadn't blossomed either, and that had a lot to do with it. You know, people stay out in the burbs. They don't have to come to Georgetown anymore.
Or they don't have to go anywhere.
That's, yeah, even more to the point. So, again, when I mention the Bayou now to somebody who's under 50 years old, it's a good chance they've never heard of it.
And so we were talking just before we went on the program about sort of what we're guessing, not only the turnout for tonight's panel, but the age, like the average age. And it's just funny to think about these things, about how things are generational by and large. And, you know, I don't know, what drives someone to care about something that came before? And so you walk around Georgetown now, and I'm not going to be with that guy who's going to bash the present and say everything was better back in the day. I'm not that guy. But, you know, a lot of retail, a lot of shopping, that kind of stuff. And back in the day, there's a little more flavor, let's say.
Well, I think also, I mean, rents certainly have had a lot to do with it. I mean, I've even just the restaurant folks that I do, because you knew everybody in Georgetown back in those days. And
yeah, Linda Roth said it was a village.
I think that's it's, Linda certainly knows. I mean, there was Nathan's. There's still Clyde's. They're still around. John Latham was a local guy who started all that up. They've been able to survive those numbers, but. The third edition is probably the last one. Billy Martin's is still there. God bless them. One of the oldest. I think they've been there since the 40s. But I walked through not too long ago, and I don't know anybody anymore.
Yeah. You know, and I was going to interrupt. And, you know, the Songbird Cafe, which I really like down the street here from this hotel, a record boutique and a cafe, coffee house. But they do live music, too. And it's just funny to think, you know, how these places have a life, and they have patrons, and the life changes and things go on.
It's getting old as hell. But then you look at what happened over, I guess, on U Street, with the way that's evolved. You know, that's an area that nobody wanted for the longest time after the riots back in 68. Now you got a bunch of kids who come in over there and, you know, are willing to take a chance. You look at what's going on in Main Avenue, the 930 Club, Pearl Warehouse,
and all the stuff down on the wharf.
Yeah, I mean, very exciting. That's the new generation of it, I suppose. So it still lives and breathes, and there's a lot of joints out in the burbs as well now. Mm-hmm. But we kind of always thought Georgetown would be there, at least as a music place forever. And
it's just not.
And nothing is. Nothing lasts forever.
Yeah. So. And then we can move on to the documentary a little bit and then talk about the panel in more detail and wrap things up, I guess. So the documentary, Dave Lilling is the director, and then we have Bill Scanlon, who's one of the production team or the producers. But can you tell me, do you recall, did Dave email you, or what was the origin of the documentary, if you can recall?
Dave Lilling came to me. I don't think we had been out of the club all that long. And... No.
So early 2000s?
He had mentioned to me he was going to do a documentary. I didn't know Dave from anybody in the world.
But time frame-wise, where is this fall?
This was not too long. This must have been not too long before word had gotten out that the building was going to be demoed.
Oh, okay.
And I think, as I understand it, Dave, who's never done documentaries before or since, to the best of my knowledge, Dave was brought in to shoot some scenes by some of the local TV stations, NBC, et cetera, of the building and the fact it was going to come down because they wanted them for their news broadcast. And so Dave, I think, hooked up with Bill Scanlon, maybe Nuttycombe, and he said, boy, there's a real story down here, isn't there? They said, yeah, there's a big story. Dave got caught up in it, got a hold of me. I gave him a bunch of names, and he's tenacious as all get out, and he just started sticking his mic in front of people and asking questions, grabbed up a bunch of people. Then it went away for a while, and I thought it had just lost its steam. Turned out Dave had had to take a little bit of a hiatus. His health hadn't been good. He had to table the project for almost 5 years. I get a call back from him, and this is probably in about 2012, something along those lines. He says, Mike, I got to get this thing done. He says, you know, people are dying. We got to get this thing out there. The great thing that happened during that period of time was Facebook. Facebook, all of a sudden, all the materials that Dave couldn't get his hands around or people he couldn't find, now he was finding them. And this really expanded the story. And it turned out to be a good delay. And I thought Dave did an extraordinary job.
Yeah, it's very good. It's very, very, yeah. You know, all the archival images and some of the documentation and the video and the audio and...
And the way he pieced it together in three parts, you know, the Dixieland era, the Tremonti era, if you will, and the Celadore era, I thought that was brilliant on his part. I was certainly too close to it to have been able to, you know, pull that off.
And it came out in 2013, as I said, and it premiered in Maryland somewhere.
PBS.
Yeah.
It was on the Maryland stations first. Then I think it ultimately played over on the Virginia side, and it got a life before everything was said and done. I think it's played in over 40 different markets, at least a half a dozen different countries around the world. So it was a story that had, I guess maybe every town had a club or something along those lines, because a lot of folks related to it nationwide.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, as a guy who works for the library, I feel like every town, city that has that local club, if it's defunct, should have a documentary made about it and available to people, you know?
Dave said something interesting about it, too. He said, Mike, he says, next time you see anybody else's documentary, I think this is a credit to him, by the way, he was crediting us. He said, they've always got a narrator. They typically do. He said, the Bayou Doc doesn't. He said, you guys told such great stories. He says, we didn't need a narrator. Now, I think that was Dave's ability to piece that whole story together, but it's kind of an interesting point of reference on that, on the way he pulled that thing off.
So tonight's panel is Mike Tremonti, Bill Scanlon, as we said, a producer on the documentary, Richard Harrington, also a fan of that guy and his writing from way back. Library's got his sort of homemade alternative arts newspaper called Woodwind, and Richard's just written a lot about local music and national acts, of course, coming through. Very knowledgeable guy about the 60s and 70s and onward. Surf Colwell, who you mentioned, he's bringing his book called Surf's Up. My joke is he waited his whole life so he could write a book just so he could have that pun in the title. He's selling copies of that tonight. The documentary will be on sale
and
tonight.
It's a good book. Just to interrupt for a minute, I've read Surf's book. In fact, I paid for it, Surf. By the way, you should have given me a copy for free, but it's a great read for any local information and things that went on. Surf had a hell of a perspective on
it. Yeah, and we can talk about Surf a little bit and then move on to Mike O'Hara. But so Surf, it just seems like, you know, you mentioned the radio station, and Surf talks about the nature of radio then in the 70s. You know, he's got these stories about Bruce Springsteen and what was it? They would play tracks that no one would know. Is that correct? Do I understand that?
WHFS was infamous for that. I mean, they, whenever we did, I mean, the mainstream stations were WPGC, DC 101, WEAM. I mean, that's where you went for your top 40 advertising. HFS, I mean, when we were bringing in something different, whether it was the blues or some sort of an artsy group, something nobody had heard from, HFS was the go-to station for that. Because they were playing all these different types of music. They were breaking new bands that nobody had heard from. The disc jockeys had a lot of leeway up there in their own formats. And if that existed anywhere else except another college station, I'm unaware of it.
Right, and Surf touched the lives. I don't want to say that. He met many famous celebrities. The cover of the book is he's hanging out with George Harrison. From the Beatles, if no one knows. So he's, you know, he has, and then those Bruce Springsteen stories, like I said, he seems to have had a very rich rock and roll life, I guess, at that time and even now.
Well, he really has. And again, talk about they talk about the short period of time an athlete has in his given sport. I mean, it can't be any better for a DJ. I mean, the longevity of surf in this industry is really, really quite extraordinary.
And then circling back to Mike O'Hara and Facebook, but so Mike ran Gentleman Chew Club, sort of a early singles bar, and boy, what is this? Late 60s.
Late 60s. Mike originally started doing work with my dad at the Bayou. He had something called JOPA, Junior Officers and Professionals Association. And they would take the club on Sundays. And you weren't allowed to sell liquor on Sundays back then, but it was a private party. And Mike managed to finagle his way around those rules. And, you know, again, before there was social media or anything else, Mike had a mailing list the size of this room. I mean, he's just a terrific promoter. And after building up his reputation at the club, he went on to do Gentleman 2, I think the first, might have been the first singles club in the country of its type. It was evolved in my mother's place, the Beowulf. Later on, Tramps, which was the disco club of D.C. and famous worldwide, and then ultimately Champion Sports Bar. So
right, and I could stop you at Tramps. So one of the things about Mike that comes to mind is he was very good at promotion, as you say, and one of the things I want to ask him tonight about sort of that adage about you give people things that they don't know they need, and it seems like Mike, with the singles club and the disco and with the sports bar, he somehow was able to create these places that were very popular, you know, that just had a huge draw. And that's something that I'm attracted to. And then the other thing is just his over-documentation of, you can open up his scrapbooks and go to his Facebook page and you're there, you know?
He just saw things coming before other folks. He was able to latch on to it. One of the things I admired that Mike said to me, because most club owners will tell you they know everything. Oh, I could do this, I could do that. And I remember one day Michael said, you know what, Mike? He says, I can't make a hamburger. I can't make a cocktail. I can't do this. He said, but I'll tell you what, he says, I can put asses in the seats. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, here's an honest man. Mike knows what he knows. And he focused in on it and just was brilliant at it.
Yeah, and he had a very specific vision, if you want to call it that. I'm speaking of Tramps right now, and how he kind of locked into that and made it a place for people to want to go to, and then transitioned out of that into the, you know, one of the nation's first sports bar and sports bars and Champions. All of this down in Georgetown.
Well, correct, and ultimately became, you know, such a featured sports bar that the Marriott Corporation bought the rights from Mike. That. I mean, so that was a great home run for Michael.
Right. And so tonight's panel is at 3260 R Street Northwest. That's at the Georgetown Public Library in the basement in the conference room. So Mike, through Facebook, I reached out to him just because I was so taken by the history I was seeing there of shots of people dancing and celebrities coming through and sort of how he built that from the ground up. Is all there on his Facebook, the scrapbooks. So he has physical scrapbooks, and then he scans all that stuff and shares that and kind of spreads that out there and disseminates it to people and all over the world. And it's kind of neat. I had this theory, and I proposed to him, and I don't think he took it up, but I still like it, and that's why I'm bringing it up. But so Mike talks about being the entertainer and having fun, and he created these places for people to have fun. And he's doing that now on Facebook. So that's my theory. He's creating this space where he's not political. He's not religious. He has no real sort of thing he's getting across, really, as much as just sort of like a fun, you know, fun, amiable kind of tone.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's an extension of what Michael's always done so well. I mean, I look at his post. I have an occasion to chime in on it. As far as the documentary goes, some of those great black and whites that we've got, God bless Michael, he was taking pictures back then and saving them. Those came from Michael's collection. Oh. We wouldn't have had any of those pictures you'll see in the front end of the documentary if it hadn't been for Michael.
And
he's a great collector.
I'm using up all my quips and quotes for tonight right now, unfortunately. But one of the other things I think is really funny is that Mike is still doing that. He's still the promotions guy. He emailed me on or sent me a message on Facebook 2 days ago or very recently about Have you reached out to the Georgetowner yet about your event? You should get in touch with those guys. Have you called the Post yet? You should get in touch with John Kelly. He's got a... So Georgetowner published a nice little promotional piece this morning. I never would have done that, and Mike was on it and getting it done, you know. It's just very funny to me. But it'll be a great gathering tonight. I'm really excited. But I wanted to sort of close on what you guys do today. And, you know, Bobby's working at the Italian store, and you're playing in a group. And
I am. I'm playing in a group called Blue House Project, which are this sort of evolved out of the Last Call event we had at the Hamilton back in 2013 to kick off the documentary. These are guys I've played with, gosh, for 35, 40 years, Ron Fentner, Corey Holland, and Tom McCarthy. We have a new CD out, which is doing well, getting a little airplay here and there. The thing that happened, my dad had a couple of good ideas. Right after the Bayou, we opened up something called the Italian Store in Lyon Village. And that was my brother, myself, and my mom and dad. And my brother now has two stores and been a tremendous success, and both in Arlington.
And that's Bobby. I know he's really busy with
them. Yeah, Delicatessens. And so we've been very fortunate that way.
Okay.
Better to be lucky than smart.
And I will repeat something you said to me, and we can wrap this up. But I interview we did several months ago, you said that something about we didn't screw it up. Like, I asked you, well, what did you guys, you know, what do you think about it now? Did it close at the right time? And when the Bayou closed, did it feel like it was the right time? And you had some comment, which is great.
You mean in the sense of when we sold it, or just when it closed in general? When we sold it, I think in retrospect, the timing was good for us as a family and for what we went on to do. It's always good to look back. And then, again, you know, people, my line is... you're correct. I mean, people ask me, geez, Mike, you did such a great job at the Bayou. You did this, that, and the other thing. It was a time and a place. We had wonderful people, wonderful music. And the wonderful thing that I did is I didn't screw it up.
Right. And I wanted to say that one other final piece about tonight's panel is Jack Boyle, and sort of what I'm calling remembering Jack Boyle, because he was such a big presence on the landscape back then with the Cellar Door and then Cellar Door Productions. And do you want to comment on that, and then we can wrap?
No question about it. Jack actually tried to buy the club for my dad in 1969, and it didn't happen. Dad said, you know, everything's got a price on it. It's got a thing, and they weren't able to come together on that. As an attorney, real estate's what my father did. But later on, as we got to 1979, that wheel turned again, and Jack came to my father again, and they were able to come together on a deal. But it was a terrific sale. That rarely happens in this business or in many businesses. We were ready to go. Jack did all the right things, took care of business. Was very good about it. You know, you had a handshake with Jack, at least we did, and they did everything they were supposed to do. So that was and I think they did a heck of a job with the club from there on too. I think they carried on in a very in a way that, you know, we were proud of. Still have the name.
And then if I understand correctly, Jack went on to sort of an enormous success on sort of a national level.
Yeah, I'm assuming too much here. Cellar Door Productions, people usually think of that little place up on the corner, but they became the largest concert promoter in the country, which maybe meant the world. And that's, it ultimately morphed into what Live Nation is now.
And that's what I'm getting at, is a seed that started here in D.C., in Georgetown, the area we're talking about, and it grew to take over the country, and then sort of like you said, like we can assume the world of entertainment.
Yeah. They opened up Nissan Pavilion. That was their property, which is a local thing. I guess they call it Jiffy Lube or whatever it is these days. But if you saw the Rolling Stones playing in one place, there was a good chance they were playing in 30 or 40 different locations, and Cellar Door Productions were the promoters.
Oh, great.
A lot of people don't know their name. They always kept their heads down. They weren't real gregarious about promoting themselves, per se, but that was Jack and Dave Williams' nature.
Yeah, yeah. Is there anything else you want to cover before we go?
No, I'd just like to see everybody come out tonight. I think if you've enjoyed this little bit of repartee between Ray and myself, I think you'll really get a kick out of it tonight.
And Mike and I have a $5 bet on something, so we'll just see how that
plays
out.
Yeah, you're going to lose it, but we're going to have an over-under tonight.
So great.
I've taken the over, by the way, on how many folks are going to show up, so I want to see you come out.
So thanks again, Mike, for speaking with me today in the lobby of the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan. I have a couple of events to announce for the library, but thanks, Mike, and folks, come out tonight. Georgetown Public Library Conference Rooms from 6:30 to 8:30, 3260 R Street. Last call, the Bayou Cellar Door in Georgetown Nightlife. Should be fun. I don't want to win that bet. So a few great upcoming events this week as part of the DC Library Series, The People's University, a year of arts, activism, and education commemorating the 50th anniversary of the events of 1968 in DC. Thursday, April 19th, 6:30 p.m. at Shepherd Park Library, the professor George Derek Musgrove will speak about his new book, Chocolate City, A History of Race and Democracy in the Nation's Capital. And on Wednesday, April 18th, you can come make a poster with local activists, artists, and create a hunger wall at poster workshops. You can see your artwork installed in library locations later in the spring and summer. Inspired by multi-ethnic, multi-racial activism of the Poor People's Campaign in 1968, that brought 50,000 protesters to D.C. to demand an end to poverty, and by the interactive mural known as the Hunger Wall, the D.C. Public Library is creating displays of posters by four local activist artists who use art as a tool for resistance and social justice. Nando Alvarez, Adrian Gaither, and Monolith D.C., and Justin Poppy, co-founders of the 411 Collective. All spring and summer, these posters will be displayed in the branch libraries and installed in temporary locations throughout the city. So keep an eye out for that. Join our artists and create your own poster. Explore the issues of 1968 and 2018 starting this Wednesday. Special workshop for teens, April 18th at 5 p.m. at McKinley Technical High School. So there's our workshops available at April 22nd at the West End Library, April 25th at 2:30 p.m. at the Shaw Library, and April 28th at Northeast Library. This has been an episode of DCPL's All Things Local on Full Service Radio. Broadcasted live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and have a great day. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you having me.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.